really fun to work here on a great staff. We've also got a great elder board and a great deacon board. So just really appreciate the work that all of you men and women do. We're in James, so if you have a New Testament, please turn to the first chapter of James. So as we're doing our thing here this morning, we've got a bunch of kids and adults in Mexico. It took them 2 days to drive. It's like almost to California. And they're building houses and stuff like that. So Ian and Jonathan and Charlie are on that trip. And then tomorrow morning, Chantel and the kids are doing kids camp all this week. So that's going on. And then Delin is chaperoning one of her kids in Europe this week. So we need to pray for her because that'll be pretty tough. Men's retreat is coming up. It's 4 months away. You need to plan, right? So I'm going to remind you guys, we're having a planning meeting right after this up in the fireside room, pizza and everything. But October 28th through 30 is our men's retreat. That's the main time that we gather every year. So it's not too soon to put that on your calendars and save up a couple of Starbucks a week. We're in James, as I said, second week. Last week we started it. The message is a translation by Eugene Peterson. He translated the Bible. And at the beginning of every book, he does a little intro. Let me just read a little bit from James. He says, "When Christian believers gather in churches, everything that can go wrong sooner or later does. So Christian churches are not model communities of good behavior. They are rather places where human misbehavior is brought out in the open, faced, and dealt with. And the letter of James shows one of the church's early pastors skillfully going about his work of confronting, diagnosing, and dealing with areas of misbelief and misbehavior that had turned up in his own congregations. He wants to give them wisdom. And wisdom is not just knowing stuff, but it is the skill of living, putting what we know into practice. And so last week, we looked at trials, difficult times, things that we're going through that we don't want to go through. But James said, you know, there's a joy to it, if you look at it this way, that God exists, that he's a loving father, and that he can actually help us to grow up and endure and become persevering, steadfast people. And this verse, verse 12, I think summarized the first 12 verses. It summarized that first section. So let me read this. "Blessed is the one," sounds like the Sermon on the Mount, doesn't it? "Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him." So he's saying, you know, you'll be blessed, you'll be happy, you'll be encouraged by the fact that God's going to cause you to grow up. And it's going to take some of these rough spots in life to do that sometimes. Now, the interesting thing is the word for trial and the word for temptation is the same Greek word. The way we figure out which one he's using is the context. So today we're going to talk about two things that might seem like they don't fit. Temptation and God's goodness. But I think we'll see that they interact quite a bit. What is temptation all about? When's the first time somebody told you not to go to the grocery store when you're hungry, right? When you're in high school, college, whatever, you know, and you go and you're just like famished and there's this big void and you think you just might not even live through the experience because you're so hungry, right? And you go into the grocery store and everything looks good, whether it's good for you or not, right? You want the Captain Crunch cereal or you want the Pop-Tarts. This is how I go to the store, you know. My wife gives me the list. I cannot find these things. I don't know where they are. She just goes right to them. But I'm just like, if I go hungry, I want everything. And then you go home and you have a sandwich and you go, why did I get all this junk now? You know, I don't need it. But at the time, it was very tempting. I want that thing. I've got a need. I want that to fill it, right? So temptation, there's all kinds of temptations. When I say that word, I'm not sure what you're thinking. You might be, you know, dealing with this or that situation. Maybe even now, maybe you're tempted to something. And so, for instance, stealing. Maybe you're tempted to steal. Maybe that's your thing. The very first memory I have in my entire life was stealing. I was about 2.5 or 3 years old. And I remember going to a neighborhood birthday party for a kid that was like 1 or 2, younger than me, right? And I saw this red balloon, and I wanted that balloon really bad, you know? And I remember stealing that balloon and then walking outside and standing on the steps. I was like, just the very first memory of my whole life. And I remember standing there thinking, I'm a little thief. And I loved, but the balloon was so enticing. I really, really wanted it. And yet I knew I had done something wrong and I was probably going to be in trouble. So even at that early age, it's like I was really tempted. And as one of my friends said, the easiest way to deal with temptation is just give in. You know, that just kind of solves it. Maybe you're tempted to violence. I mean, that's what this might have been written to. People are trying to figure out the context of James. And a lot of these people he's writing to were being oppressed economically. They didn't have, you know, the Jews didn't accept the new Jewish believers. The Gentiles didn't accept them. So they were having a hard time. And there may have been some temptation to like lash out with violence or theft, you know, just to meet their needs. Sexual temptation. We tend to think about that a lot because it's like all over our culture. And actually this passage is written in such a way that it sounds like it's sexual temptation. Cheating on taxes, cheating on this, cheating on that, fudging on that, information, lying, hating people, struggling with whatever addiction it is that really is your thing. That every week, maybe it's like it's a struggle, it's a temptation. Anger at your kids, what cowardice. And I was watching this movie called The Finest Hours, and it's an amazing movie. And these guys go out in this boat, and these other guys are going, just quit, just give up, you know? And so maybe there's these voices tempting you to not do the bold thing in life that you need to do. So anyway, he's going to talk about temptations because certain trials, if you handle them well, and you ask God for help, and you persevere, you know, you grow stronger. But that same trial can become a temptation to do something wrong with the situation. And so what he says in 13 and 14 is this. When you're tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. I don't know if that's your temptation or not. Maybe, you know, we all want to push away the responsibility. I'm tempted, but it's not my fault. It's, you know, God's tempting me, or the devil's tempting me, or this person's tempting me, or whatever. But he says, if you're tempted, when you're tempted, don't say God's tempting me. Because God can't be tempted by evil. That's just the definition of God. He's fully, completely good. There's nothing about evil that's enticing to him. He's not tempted by evil, and he doesn't tempt other people, tempting them to do something wrong. But, verse 14, each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. This word evil desire, sometimes it's translated lust, what it really means is a really, really strong desire. Someone has said it's not necessarily wanting a bad thing, but it's wanting a good thing really, really badly. And so I've got four principles today, and the first one is this. Hopefully they're restating the obvious. Temptation doesn't come from God. Temptation comes from us. Comes from us. We just want to push it off to someone else, like my little son, David, when he was 4 years old. You know, I've told this story before. He takes the red marker and goes along the wall with it, and then it goes into his room and right by his bed, and he just denied that he'd done it. And I said, I'm not asking you if you did it, David. I know you did this. Just tell me why. And he goes, and he's searching, and he can't blame anybody else, although he tried. He went through our whole family system, and none of those worked. So finally, he just goes, my brain forgot it was wrong. And I just said, that's not going to work. So we have this tendency to want to blame, right? Before there was any sin, you know, there's Adam and Eve. They've got this great relationship with God, and he's great, and they're great with him, and they're finding their life in him, and this serpent comes along, and Satan starts twisting their idea of God, if you think about it, Genesis 3. The first thing the serpent does is start redefining God. Is he really good? Is he really want to help you? Isn't he trying to keep you from some good things? Isn't he kind of legalistic? And then they're starting to wonder, well, maybe God's not so good. Maybe he's not like, and that's what happens with us, is that we start getting a distorted view of God. Maybe he is kind of against me. I have been, you know, encountering all these problems. And so Adam and Eve fall. They sin because they do the one thing that God said, I don't want you to do this. It's going to hurt you. And I want your good. But they'd forgotten who he was. And so Adam's answer to all this after God confronts him is, you know, God, it's that woman that you gave me, which is really a great answer, because men have been using this for centuries ever since. Really, you know, it's like, God, I'd be fine if it wasn't for this woman that you gave me. Or wives do it for their husbands. I'd be fine if it wasn't for that guy, and you know all about him. But that doesn't work either. The ideal thing is not to be like Adam. It's to be like Joseph, right? You got Joseph in the Old Testament. Now, if anybody could have gotten upset, it would have been Joseph, his own brothers. You know, he's one of the 12 sons of Jacob. And he gets thrown, his brothers get mad at him, and they take him away and they throw him in a pit, and then they sell him to the Egyptians, and the Egyptians take him to their country. And so he ends up in this other place. He doesn't know what to do. And, you know, things start going well, and then he's working for this guy named Potiphar, and then Potiphar's wife wants to have sex with him. And he could have easily said, God, you know, you put me in this situation. What am I going to do? You know, I got to have sex with her. She's bugging me about it every single day. But that's not what Joseph did. He goes, this is wrong. It's bizarre. And he actually runs away from her. And then he gets thrown in prison for that. If anybody could have gotten upset, it would have been Joseph. Like, what are you doing to my life? You're ruining it, God. But instead, he just keeps making the right choices. Where is Satan in all this? Well, Satan's out there. He doesn't want our success spiritually, but that's not what James is talking about in this passage. Later on, in chapter 4, he says, resist the devil and he will flee from you. And if, back in the day, there was this comedian named Flip Wilson, really long time ago, and he would always say what? The devil made me do it, right? So James is saying, God didn't make you do it. God's not tempting you. That's not his character. That's not the way he works. And you can't blame it on the devil right now. It comes from you. It comes from you. You are, each person is tempted, verse 14, when they are dragged away by their own evil desire and enticed. So if you become a Christian, you're a new person. I'm a new person in Christ. He changes our lives. But we still have this thing called the flesh. And the flesh is that ability to choose to sin. It's the ability to wake up any morning and go, God, I'm just going to live this day on my own. I don't care what you want. I'm just going to ignore you. That's the flesh. I just want to do what I want to do, right? Never works out very well, but that's part of us. There was this hotel in Galveston, Texas. I've never been to Galveston, so I don't know. Actually, the hurricane hit it in 2008, and they had to close this hotel, but up until then, it was called the Flagship Hotel. Really cool hotel right on the water. I don't know if any of you were there. It had these plate glass windows. And so, you know, the dining room looks out over the water. And, of course, you know, this hotel is really tall. So you got all these balconies right above that. And so what people start doing after a while is they start fishing off the balconies. They just say, hey, we're right here on the water. And to get the, you know, the lure way out there, they're going to have to, these really strong sinkers, you know. And so they throw it out there, and a lot of times the line is too short. So it goes way out there, and there's a really heavy sinker, and it comes right back, and it smashes the windows, and people are eating their lunch, and what's going on? It costs $600 every time they do that. And so the management of the hotel just kept trying to figure out, what are we going to do to stop this? And finally, after a long time, somebody says, let's take out the signs in every room that say, no fishing from the balcony. Because, see, they had these signs in the rooms saying, no fishing from the balcony. So people like us, because we're so twisted, and we have the thing called the flesh, it's like, I want to fish. I didn't want to fish till I saw that sign, right? It's like, don't walk on the grass. I'm walking on the grass. I don't care. I want to fish off the balcony so bad. And once you take the sign away, suddenly it's like, it didn't even occur to me. That's how twisted we are. And James says, there's these desires that you have, and they entice you, and they drag you away. The more power you give, the more you walk alongside them. And then verse 15, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's full grown, gives birth to death. Strange way to put it, but it's pretty accurate, right? James is saying, if you look at a situation and you follow the enticement of your overly evil desires and you go in that direction, it's always going to promise life and it will never, ever deliver. And that's my second point. The second point is this, if we can bring that up. Sin never delivers on its promises. Sin promises life and delivers death. It always looks great. It always looks like it's going to come through. And you know, we have these needs in our lives. We need security and significance. And if, you know, we want love, we want relationship, we want to matter, we want to make an impact on our world. That's the way we're wired. And God has wired us to have those needs met in a relationship with Him. I'm secure in Him because He will never stop loving me. I matter to Him. He thinks highly of me. And so when I'm in a relationship with Him, those needs get met. But when I'm not, if I haven't come into a relationship with Him or I'm not focused on Him, suddenly there's this void. And it's like, man, I really want to meet and when we have those needs, we're going to meet them somewhere. We're going to meet them through a person or a thing or a choice or whatever. If we have this emptiness inside of us, we're going to find something that's going to meet that need. King David, great guy, right? We love King David, great fighter and poet and all that. You know, he decides he's not going to go to war one day. So it was springtime. Kings are supposed to go out to war. He goes, I think I'm going to sit this one out. I got a good army. I got good generals. I'm just going to stay home. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll figure that out as I go along. So he decides one night to go up on the roof, which is something that they would do. You know, it's cooler up there at the end of the day. And he looks over. There's this woman taking a bath, you know, and she looks pretty good to him. And so he probably thought, you know, God, I'm just up here minding my own business, right? And this woman is naked over there. Certainly she knows I'm here. It's not my fault, right? I don't know what's going on. It's not my fault. It's your fault for making her, for making this. I'm just this innocent bystander. But he just keeps looking. He keeps focusing. And he says, you know, I'm king. If I ask her to come over, she probably will. So he does. It's like mistake after mistake, red flag after red flag. It just keeps going. She gets pregnant. He tries to cover it up by killing her husband. He lies about it. He does everything he can think of. He breaks all these rules. And he should die for it. And he doesn't die. The child dies, right? And part of him kind of dies because he's never, even though God forgives him, he's never exactly the same afterwards. He's kind of wounded from this. Sin never delivers on its promises. It always promises life and delivers death. And so in verse 16, perhaps James is thinking about Adam and Eve, and he says, don't be deceived. Don't be deceived. My dear brothers and sisters. And so this is a kind of ancient wisdom literature, and often wisdom literature tries to warn us about life. For instance, did you ever read about the Odyssey, you know, Greek mythology? There's this guy named Odysseus, and he goes on this long journey. And then part of that journey, he's going along, and he's in this ship, and he's heard about these sirens that are on one of the islands. Sirens are these women that have these beautiful song and these beautiful voices, and evidently you can't even resist them. You just want to go to them. And by the way, if you saw Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, it's the same story, but in modern day. And so Odysseus says, I really want to hear these sirens. I want to hear. And they go, don't do it. Don't do it. Everybody says not to do it. I want to do it. I just want to hear what they sound like. I think I can resist. So why don't you lash me to the mast of the ship so I can't do anything? And no matter what I tell you, don't believe me, right? Don't go over there. And they're going, well, you're the, you know, captain. So, and he says, put wax in your ears so you can't hear them. I just want to hear what they sound like. He's kind of playing with fire, right? And we kind of want to do that sometimes. So he, you know, he goes, and as they get closer, they see something on the shoreline. What is it? It's the bones of all these dead sailors that have gone over there and crashed and died. Now, there's a very similar kind of story in Proverbs chapter 9. I love this. Proverbs 9 is great. And it's the story of two women. And one woman's name is Wisdom, and one woman's name is Folly. And I love this. It's so creative. Wisdom, this woman Wisdom, she builds her house. She carves the seven columns in the house. She prepares a great banquet. She mixes the wine. She sets the table. She sends her servants to invite people. She does a lot of work to prepare good stuff. She actually puts effort into it so that she has something to offer. She really has good stuff to offer. And after all that, she calls out from the heights overlooking the city. She says to everybody, come in with me. She urges the simple. Now, in the book of Proverbs, a simple person is undecided. Let's say you're trying to figure out who to vote for. You haven't decided yet. That's simple. It's like, I just can't decide, right? And so she's saying, if you haven't decided yet whether Wisdom or Folly is good, come in here and all this stuff I have to give you, she says, to those who lack judgment, come eat my food, drink the wine I've mixed, leave your simple ways behind and begin to live. So Wisdom's good. She's got a lot of good gifts and she legitimately wants to give life to the people that she's calling to. Now, changes gears. There's another woman. This woman's name is Folly. It's foolishness. She's brash. She's ignorant, and she doesn't even know it. She sits in her doorway on the heights overlooking the city. She hasn't done a thing. She doesn't build her house. She doesn't make food. She doesn't make wine. She hasn't prepared anything because she's not going to need it. But she says the exact same thing to people. She calls out to men going by who are minding their own business, and she says, come in with me. She urges the simple. To those who lack good judgment, she says, stolen water is refreshing. Stolen water is better than like regular water. And food eaten in secret tastes the best. If you steal stuff, it's way better than regular stuff. But little do they know that the dead are there, that her guests are in the depths of the grave. Does that sound like your life? You ever experienced that? You hear these voices calling to you. One of them just sounds a little too good to be true, and it ends in death. Actually, the other one sounds too good to be true. You know, if you hear the voice of Jesus, it's like, this is too good to be true, but it's really, really good. Someone named Portia Nelson wrote this little thing called An Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. I wanted to show it to you, see if this brings it to life a little bit. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm hopeless. It isn't my fault. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit, but my eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down a different street. Maybe that's your life story. Now, Here's where I think these two sections fit together. Normally we'd look at this and go, okay, so you just need willpower. You just need to say no, right? When you have temptation, just say no. It's wrong. And then you go, but yeah, but I don't have really strong willpower. Or you need to read the Bible and figure out that it's wrong. So you know it's wrong, but I think there is a stronger antidote to temptation. I think we find it in 17 and 18. In verse 17, James says, "Now every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of the heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows." And this is my third point. Third point is this. God gives life, a kind of life that is full of goodness, truth, and beauty. And I started thinking about this. I started thinking about Facebook. Now, Facebook's got some weird stuff on it, right? And it all comes from people. And there's some angry stuff, and there's some venting stuff, and there's some, you know, negative stuff. But, you know, maybe it's the friends I have. But at the same time, there's a lot of really good stuff that's on there. And what I mean by good is we celebrate the good things in our lives by saying, I want everybody to know about this, right? And so we celebrate our pets. We've got dogs, and some of you have cats. I'm not a big cat person, right? I'm not like wanting every cat to die. I mean, that's sick, right? Nobody would want that. But, you know, I'm not real thrilled with cats, maybe because I'm, like, allergic to them. Some people just love cats. But anyways, people love their animals, their pets, their dogs, right? And people love movies. They love stuff that they see, that sort of resonates with them. They love their kids. My kid does something. Isn't he cute? You know, of course, we're posting pictures of our grandbabies now, and everybody's really sick of them. But she's really sweet, you know, and I love her, and I think she's great. Now she's gone. You know, she was here for the week, and our kids took her back, and part of that's good. But it's really kind of sad, too, and because she's great. I just loved her being around. Music. Some of you are into music. Some of you are into opera, country music, pop music, whatever kind of music it is. And there's certain music that you just really, really love. I mean, there's certain passages in songs that are my favorites, and I listen to it and I go, that's awesome. And C.S. Lewis said, all these good things are hints of something that's even better. Because you'll notice if you put too much weight on any one of these things, on kids, or pets, or relationships, or music, or movies, or the arts, or anything, even if they're really, really good things, we put too much weight on them, they can't handle it. And what Lewis said was, these things are just hints that there's something greater, and the fact that we even can imagine something greater is proof that it exists. We say, I wasn't made for this world. I can imagine something better. And these things that we love that are good gifts are just hints. And I think that's what he's talking about. Every good and perfect gift. Something really, really good comes into your life. You can trace that back to God. Good things exist because God is good. Some people will say, well, I don't mind going to hell because all my friends will be there, right? Guess what? There's no friendship in hell. Why? Because friendship is a good thing. It doesn't work without God. So all these little hints that we have about how incredible God is, we find in the good things that he gives us in life. And he doesn't change at all. He's not like partly dark, partly light. He doesn't change like shifting shadows. And then in verse 18, he tells us the best thing of all. And this is where I want to transition into. We're going to celebrate communion today. We're going to do it by intinction, which means in just a moment, you get up and go to one of these tables. This far table over here is gluten-free for those of you that need that. And if you can't get up out of your seat, that's fine. Just raise your hand and we will bring the elements to you. But we're celebrating communion by the bread and the cup. And when we take the bread, we are remembering that Jesus gave his body for us. And you dip it in the cup, and that's representing the new covenant that he created with his own blood that he shed in his death. Because in verse 18 it says this, God chose to give us birth through the word of truth that we might be a kind of first fruits of all he created. He chose to give us birth. Now, I think in the New Testament, it's like you've got a coin and two sides of the coin. And if you asked me how I became a Christian, I'd tell you, well, I searched for a year and I looked at this religion and that philosophy. And I finally rediscovered Jesus and I gave my life to him and he came into my life. And that's true. That's kind of the my search part side of the coin. But I look at it now and I go, God was at work. God was at work, and for some reason, he chose to set his love upon me, and he chose to wake me up from my slumber, and he chose to give me life. He caused me to come into a relationship with Jesus. He's sovereign. And that's what James is saying. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth. He caused me to be born into his family. He gave me life. Is there anything better than that? And so what you see in this passage is one person's being tempted and they're saying, well, it's God's fault. And James is saying, no, God isn't like that. Think about what he gives. Everything he gives is good. Every good thing in life came from him. And ultimately, the best thing of all is he gave you his own son. And he sent us his son who absorbed our evil and our sin, took it upon himself so that then he could give us back freedom and a new life and salvation and forgiveness and all these wonderful gifts. He just gave them to us, to anyone who asks. And that's what we celebrate. So you had Adam being tempted, failing. You had the Son of God, Jesus Christ, going out into the wilderness and being tempted. And he knew these things were wrong when the devil tempted him. He said, no, that's wrong. And he knew scripture taught against it, so he was able to use that. But I think even beyond that is my fourth point, and that's this. I think the best antidote to temptation is the joy of a relationship with God. I think, again, there's this emptiness that we often experience, and we want to fill it with something, and God says, I'm the only one that can really fill that. And the more full we are with the joy of our relationship with Jesus Christ, the less tempting things will be. They won't go away completely because that's the way life is going to be on planet Earth. We're going to be tempted. We're going to be tried. But God says, ultimately, I want to fill you with so many good things and with a relationship with me that the temptation will be obviously not as good. Jesus, I think, part of the success of the way he dealt with temptation in the wilderness was, I've got a relationship with the Father. It's so good that these other things, I can tell they're not going to satisfy. And so if you don't have a relationship with Jesus, he's available to give it to you if you just ask. All you have to do is ask. And you might say, well, yeah, but you don't know what I've done. Yeah, he does. And he loves you. He wants to come into your life and fill it overflowing. Let's pray. Jesus, as we get up and walk amongst our brothers and sisters, we thank you for this family that you've created. You not only changed our lives, but you changed this whole group of people and you've made us into a family. Help us to think of what you did for us as we take this bread. Help us to remember the blood that you shed when we take this cup. Help us to grow closer to you all the time. We know that you've given all of yourself to us. Help us to experience that, to live with you each day, to know the fullness that you desire for us, that as we walk through tough times, we might hang on to you. We might not get a distorted view of you. Help us to remember that you are for us. Even when we're tempted, even when we go through hard times, even when we're tempted to walk away, you stick with us. Pray this in Jesus' name.